Blog Talk Radio.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong, it's bringing mercy, it won't be long. Healing rain is coming down, it's coming closer to the lost and found. Tears of joy and tears of shame are washed forever in Jesus' name. The healing rain, it comes with fire, so let it fall and take us higher.
Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy Noble. Hope you're having a good Tuesday. It is blistering bitter cold here in St. Louis where I live, as with most of the country. We're kind of in a deep freeze, I guess. Hopefully, prayerfully, the first inklings of spring will arrive upon us soon and we can get out of the deep freeze. This is the Tuesday edition, as I mentioned yesterday. Some technical issues with the Blog Talk Radio website, canceled my program, so today I'm in on Tuesday, but nonetheless very glad to be with you. If you've perused the site, you know the subject I'm speaking on for the next couple of weeks on the Cross in the Desert. We're going back to 1979, recalling the events of the Iranian Revolution and remembering how this really all began for my Iranian friends, how their lives have been so drastically changed by really one man. And I'm speaking of Ayatollah Khomeini, who came in on a jumbo jet 747 on February 1st, 1979, and at that moment declared Iran an Islamic state. A lot of my friends weren't born at that time. There's a few that were, and it's very, very painful for them to go way back to 1979. I have a very special story on this edition of the program today. Shabnam Sadali, an Iranian human rights activist who lives now in Ottawa, Canada. I'm going to share her story with you. I think I've done this once before, but I want to share it for a newer audience because hers is a very courageous story, and she indeed is a survivor of that time of the revolution. Well, as always, what we do here on the Cross in the Desert, we keep you updated on Pastor Saeed. Of course, he is the American Christian pastor who is being held hostage, if you will, in Iran. And I think of hostage, and I think of the Iranian hostage crisis of almost 35 years ago, and the parallels are just astounding. Here we are once again having to barter, if you will, to plead, to cry out to Iran to free our hostages. There are three of them, Ekmar Hamati and one other gentleman and Pastor Saeed. All three need to come home. Tonight is the State of the Union Address, I believe, and President Obama is going to speak to us. Nagma has said time again, I feel abandoned by my government. But let me tell you this. I had a note from Patrick Mahoney, who is doing, of course, the outreach in front of the White House, the protest there. And there was a mention of a possibility that in this evening's State of the Union address that President Obama will mention Saeed. And let's hope and pray that that is true. Today marks the one-year anniversary of when Saeed was sentenced to 8 years in prison. It is a difficult day, Nagma writes, for me, remembering the pain and the heartache I went through when I heard the news. But I'm also reminded of his goodness and how he has carried me this last year and the body of Christ, all of you, surrounding us and praying for us. Because of your prayer and support, we are seeing movement with the Iranian government. Recently, the Iranian Prime Minister, that is Zahid, spoke about clemency measures or acts of mercies that can be introduced in securing Saeed's freedom. I know with all of my heart that when Saeed is released, it is nothing short of the miracle of God, and because of all of your love and support. And Enigma ends her status update with this verse, Proverbs 21:1. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. Like the rivers of water, he turns it wherever he wishes. So appropriate, Nagma. That's exactly true. In your pain and suffering, you, as all of us, recognize that ultimately God's sovereign purposes are being worked out, and that literally the hand of God is on these leaders. His heart is turned any way he chooses to turn it. That is so true, and it's a comforting verse to know that in all of this chaos, God is ultimately truly in control. We're going to keep you updated all the time about Saeed and what is going on in his life, and letting you know day by day if there's any changes, and hopefully, prayerfully, we will hear something very, very, very soon. Well, I mentioned at the top, we're taking a look back of the 1979 Iranian Revolution. I know I was 23. This dates me. I know I'm giving away my age, but I was 23 when all of this happened. And probably at that time in my life, I really didn't have an interest, of course, like I have today, but I remember learning a little bit about it. But I want to take you back in the newsreel footage this morning and let you hear some of the sounds of the news reporting that went on during this time. Of course, we don't have the visual images here on Blog Talk Radio, but I'm sure that if many of you are my age, you'll probably remember some of the things you're going to hear. So let's hear some of the events of the revolution right now on the cross in the desert.
1978, the Ayatollah Khomeini has been exiled to Iraq, but he preaches revolution to the faithful back home in Iran. The Shah of Iran, one of the wealthiest and most powerful leaders in the world, is sitting on top of a powder keg, and he doesn't know it. Nor does his chief ally, the United States. The Ayatollah and his revolution are quietly gaining power.
Even when the riots increased, we did not anticipate that the Shah would fall in the near future. He had a large military establishment. We assumed that he would bring these out, and the group of ragtag people in the streets were not going to overthrow the Peacock Throne with all this vast internal power that it had.
But even the most perfect police state can't stand against the tide of an idea whose time has come. In Iran, that idea is the Ayatollah's dream of an Islamic state. His idea is to use his religion to effect political change. September 7, 1978. The numbers in the streets approach a million. The Shah declares martial law. September 9th. From Iraq, Khomeini calls for workers to strike all over the nation. Iran's economy grinds to a halt. November 1978. Inspired in part by Khomeini's broadcasts, more than a million come out into the streets. During holy days in early December, 9 million people demonstrate against the Shah around the country.
But by the end of 78, the revolution was full-blown, and the Shah had lost all control. It was clear that he had to go, and that's when he decided to actually leave the country.
January 16, 1979. The planes depart Iran for Egypt and exile. In jubilation, the people of Tehran pour into the streets. February 1st, 1979. A Boeing 747 is approaching Tehran International Airport. It is carrying the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the acclaimed and undisputed leader of Iran. But even the most perfect police state can't stand against the tide of an idea whose time has come. In Iran, that idea is the Ayatollah's dream of an Islamic state. His idea is to use his religion to effect political change.
And there you heard it. Some of the events that really culminated in that famous February 1st, 1979 arrival of Khomeini. And everything changed. Overnight, Shabnam, in her story, said that women had to start wearing long, dark clothing. This once had been banned under the Shah, that women were required to wear this type of clothing publicly. But things began to change almost immediately. Students that had a regular secular curriculum were now exposed to Islamic studies and the teaching of the Quran in classrooms. Many, many things almost immediately changed. We went from the secularism, the Western secularism, if you will, of Iran and the Shah to the fundamental Islamic state. At one time under the Shah, he himself even admitted that he didn't see religion and politics as very cohesive. There was kind of a separation of church and state under the Shah, if you will. But immediately with Khomeini, we had the glory of Islam return. Islamism, the fundamentalist Islamic state, was born. And that's when the freedoms of my friends quickly began to diminish. Well, we've talked a little bit about those events back in 1979 and some of the things that led to this, but what has the impact been? I don't think that that's a hard question to answer, but the way I want to try to answer it here on The Cross in the Desert is to bring you interviews of people that have been affected by it. One such interesting interview I want to talk a little bit about is about an Iranian-Swedish filmmaker named Nahid Persson Sarvastani. She has some famous documentary films, one of them Prostitution Behind the Veil, My Mother, a Persian Princess, The End of Exile, and The Last Days of Life. In 2007, she was arrested and briefly imprisoned by Iranian authorities for allegedly having shamed her native country with her documentary on two prostitutes in Tehran. And she completed another documentary, Four Wives, One Man Under Difficult, Dangerous Conditions. It's a story of a polygamous family south of Shiraz that was smuggled out of Iran and finally ended up in Sweden. And she has done many, many films, but the one I want to talk about today is My Stolen Revolution. She goes back to the time of the revolution, which we're speaking about today, and talks about the impact that it had on her friends. And what I want you to do is spend a few minutes with this Iranian-Swedish filmmaker, and she will tell you some of the events of the revolution, how it's impacted her friends' lives and her life. So we're going to hear from Nadia Persson right here on The Cross in the Desert.
I was an activist when I was in Iran, when I was young, together with many, many other Iranian young people. And but I was one of them who could flee from Iran some years ago, 34 years ago. But a lot of my friends and my two younger brothers were arrested and put in prison. Many of them were executed, included my young brother, who was just 17 years. But I could flee from Iran and have been in Sweden in many years. But 2000, I tried to ignore all the feeling I had, because it's not normal life that your brother, who is younger than you and not as active as you, be executed, but you are alive. And I was one of them who tried I was one of them who say to Rostam that come to our organization. So I felt very guilty about that. But I ignore everything because I couldn't do anything for this. But 2009, when the new generation after the election in Iran, it was 2009. So they a lot of people came out to the street. It was almost 4 million young people in Tehran, just one city. And I saw how they were arrested, how they were put in jail, and how they were dead in front of cameras. So I couldn't. I just felt it was like a repeat of my situation 30 years ago. So I thought I couldn't ignore the problem anymore because I saw that my nephews and my young sister was among them, so I couldn't just ignore everything. So it took me 30 years, took me back to 30 years ago when I was activist, and I thought I have to do something. I have to find the truth about what happened with my friends in prison and what happened to my brother, because it was very hard to think even if he was tortured or not. I just wanted to think that he was executed, that it was finished. Like, I didn't want to know anything about before he was executed. But at that time, I felt responsibility to my people. I have to find some friends who were in prison at the same time as my brother, and to know what happened, what the Islamic regime did with our young people. So it was why I began with the film. Many people outside Iran think that Iranian women, they are just, we can see just them in veil, nothing more, but Iranian women are very, very strong and very well educated, so they know their right, but they are stopped by the Islam and the regime. So it was important to make this film about the women, because they are, all people in Iran are under oppression, but the women are double or more than double under oppression, because when they came to prison, they were put in prison, they were also raped. Some of them had their children in prison with them. Some of them, they get birth to their children. So they have to take care of them also at the same time as they were tortured. So it was hard. But another reason that I have just women in my film is because when we were activists, we work together, all women and men, but in small groups it was just my group, it was just women, because it was easier to work, it was secure to work just with women. So my closest friends were women, so it was that way. I think religion is something very private for me. So I respect people's belief. It doesn't matter if they believe Marx or Engels or Islam, or if they are Jewish. It doesn't matter, as far as they don't hurt other people. So it, in my house, in my family, my dad and my mom, before the revolution, they pride. So it wasn't any big deal. It was a part of their life, and they didn't talk about that. But after revolution, my dad and my mother and the whole family, they stopped to pray, because they thought the Islamic regime took their son's life. So they didn't believe God anymore. I don't believe Islam or any other religion, but I think now when Islam, they use religion to oppression other people, and religion has been a law in Iran. So if I make a film about, doesn't matter what, they have to control everything if it's against the religion or not, so they will stop it. So my point is that some people in Sweden try to use that I'm against religion and my films, and they use it against people, against refugees maybe in Sweden or other countries, but it's wrong because I'm afraid to see that religion and Islam has been so big in all countries, so it's not good. But I don't want people's private beliefs, so you can't oppression them because of that in other countries.
Well, there you heard it. It was a rather lengthy interview from Nahid Pearson. Her documentary film, My Stolen Revolution, is about going back and finding her friends who were imprisoned during this chaotic time of the revolution, reconnecting with them. And it's a film that kind of puts them on the spotlight about what happened to them, how their lives were affected, how her life was affected. I guess it's a very personal film. One of the statements that she made in this interview was that how the regime uses Islam to oppress people, how they use religion. And that's very accurate because it's very oppressive. Remember, a lot of these people before the revolution may have been religious in some way, but now they're forced to believe a certain way, to behave a certain way. And so Nahid is exactly right on her observations that the Islamic revolution, again, took Islam and forced it on many, many people, the ethics, the code, the morality, and she's mentioning how even her own parents stopped believing in, quote, God after the Islamic regime took a stranglehold or a stronghold in Iran. And so the oppression of religion is what drives many, many Iranians to a vibrant relationship with Christ. There is a spiritual hunger and a void because of what Islam does to the people in Iran. And they feel oppressed. They feel confronted. They feel under pressure. They feel they have to live and behave a certain way without a choice. And so many, many Iranians, as a result of this oppressive belief, have turned to Christ. And this is a wonderful, positive thing, because in Jesus, our spiritual hunger, our appetite is satisfied by his unconditional love. And we see that particularly along the lines of the Iranian youth. I know just from my chatting on Facebook, my interactions from Iranians, many of them are open. Many of them have heard of Christianity. Many of them are believers. I have one friend, I can't mention her name, who really loves Jesus. And she's told me personally on many times that she did not grow up with a fascination toward the imams, and she was never to Islam, even though her parents were. And she said to me early in her life, she was just drawn to Jesus. And as a result of that today, many, many years later, and she is a believer in Christ. And I thought her testimony was very insightful, and yet she can't talk a lot about it. She's living in an Islamic society, and she can't speak up because it could mean very serious consequences for my friend in Tehran to be born in a Muslim family and to convert to Christianity is a very dangerous thing. You can lose your life for that if you live in Iran. Well, what I talked about just a minute ago about the Iranian youth, I wanted to spend a couple of minutes on this special report about Iranian youth. I found this up on YouTube. I found this fascinating. This is the story of some teenagers living in Iran who go to the Alborz Mountains to ski. And that's their place of escape away from this society, away from the daily grind of living under the regime every day. And they go to the mountains. So I want you to spend a few minutes and listen to the story of these young people in Iran right here on the cross in the desert.
He is our greatest pleasure. Just great. The entire week is like a countdown to this day for me. I think most young people come here to get rid of their frustrations. Skiing here means forgetting your worries and problems. Worries, for example, like the strict regime of the mullahs. Here in the mountains north of Tehran, young Iranians have found a haven of relative freedom over recent years. This is a paradise in their eyes, compared to the dreary reality of the Islamic Republic. Sanaz is 21 and lives in Tehran. She spends every weekend in winter out here in the mountains. She used to ski, but now she's changed to snowboarding. The long overcoat women must wear in Iran can be left at home. This resort is much more to her than just a place to do sport. Boys and girls can meet much more easily here. This is a good place to find a boyfriend. And the clothes we wear here are much more comfortable, as you can see. President Ahmadinejad's call for strict observance of the Islamic rule evaporates in the thin air of the Elbrus Mountains. The women here have bypassed the dress code. Sanaz and her friends show their hair. This transgression alone is punishable by whipping. We've got so much more freedom here. I don't have any intention of covering my head, certainly not when the guards are out of sight. It's enough bother to wear this in town. The state can't turn back the wheel of progress. Now they want to introduce separate ski peaks for men and women, but that won't happen. Unfortunately, she can only enjoy this liberty for a few hours at weekends. Monday morning sees her back in her normal life, down in Tehran, a megacity with 15 million inhabitants. Here, she works in an architect's office. She has a degree in graphic design. She's well trained, and yet as a woman, she has a subordinate role. The lack of equality, the economic crisis, and no hope of political change are three good reasons to leave Iran, she says. I can't see a future for me in Iran. I haven't got the patience to stay here. I haven't even considered the idea that I'd be forced to stay. I'd rather not think of a future in Iran. But the chance of a new life elsewhere is unlikely. Who issues visas to Iranians? Meanwhile, in Tehran, the gap between young people's yearning for freedom and the expectations of the mullah's regime widens. We're in a basement on campus at Tehran University, right next to the place where sermons are held. A rock concert in the mullah state has to be seated. Standing or even dancing are forbidden, and the sexes are not allowed to mix. We talked to some of the young rock fans after the concert. The way we dress and our music reflect the fact that we don't agree with the way things are in our country. There is no true coexistence in our society. When I have new ideas or I like something new that deviates from tradition, it will be brutally suppressed by the custodians of the state's ideals. Friday's sermon at the university. On state television, the regime celebrates its ideal of the Islamic youth. But fewer and fewer people are willing to live up to that ideal. The authorities had demanded a disciplined and quiet rock concert. We watch one boy who has a box of ecstasy pills. When you're not allowed to dance, you've got to get your kicks somehow. Two female students who witnessed the scene tell us later that drug consumption is escalating wildly among young Tehranians. All of my friends take these pills. They've even created a new expression for it. They say, tonight we're going to blow ourselves up. This goes on because pleasure is a foreign word to this society. The mullahs want us to mourn endlessly so they can have their fun. Sarcasm, drugs, rock music, and the mountains. This is where young Iranians take refuge almost 30 years after the Islamic Revolution. Up here, I feel like I'm in another country. It doesn't feel like Iran here. Young people in Iran are living in a parallel universe. Iran's theocratic leadership might despise the facts, but they can't change them.
And there you have it, the story of the youth finding an outlet, a place to go and relax from the daily grind of living under the oppressive Islamic regime. They found that hope in the Alborz Mountains, and many, many of them want to leave, want to work study programs away from Iran to get away from that environment. I have one such friend, I won't mention her name, she's on a 3-year work study program in Italy, and I remember Skyping with her about a week ago, and she described to me the ultimate freedom, just the exhilaration that she felt right there in Italy, away from Tehran, where she could walk outside without her hijab. She could walk in the company of other men and not be questioned and stopped by the Ghasti or Shad. Just the whole atmosphere of where she lives now for 3 years. And she told me, she says, you know what? When I finish here, I really don't want to go back. I have to find somewhere else to live. But this is a young lady who has found life so much more thrilling and so much more eventful now that she is away from the oppression of the Islamic rule in Iran. And even though she's on a 3-year work program, she's already planning her next stage of her life. She feels independent. She feels in control of her life to make the choices that she wants to make without fear of repercussion. And I'm just very thankful my friend has found this outlet of a place to go. In this segment, we talked about the youth wanting freedom. I have in my hands here a book, a little prayer booklet for 30 days called Iran 30. This is a booklet I hand out to my customers at every one of my book signings. It is a free pamphlet. It's put out by Alam Ministries. Alam Ministries is based all over the world. Here in the United States, they're in Atlanta, Georgia, and they work inside Iran training pastors, smuggling Bibles. They do a lot of great work with the Iranians, and of course they have to do that covertly undercover because of the rule and the laws there. And in this 30-day booklet where you pray each day for a segment of Iran for a specific topic, one of the topics on day 13 is the youth wanting freedom. And let me just read to you this entry in Iran 30. Over 16 million out of the 75 million people in Iran are under 15. Two-thirds of the population is under 30. And these millions switch off when bearded religious leaders talk about their revolution. Their minds are not on the past, but on the future. And they have two major frustrations. First, they want more social and intellectual freedom. They are tired of being told what they should wear, watch, or read. Secondly, they want meaningful jobs. Nearly 1 million enter the labor market every year. The government uses oil money to create work, but not enough. For the church, this is an extraordinary opportunity. Millions of young Iranians have time to browse the internet and watch satellite TV where they can hear about the message of Jesus. The curiosity has led many to look for a New Testament. When they find one, some finish it in a matter of days. House churches are often full of young people, and many church leaders and planters are under 25. Alam Ministry is a wonderful ministry of outreach to Iranians. And I know just from my interaction with Iranians on Facebook, many of them, I can understand and relate to them. And they're so tired. They can't relate to these older men, these mullahs, that rule over them and talk about the revolution. So what the revolution has done since 1979, it has not addressed these issues with the youth. There is such a separation between the youth and the religious leaders of Iran. They need someone to look up to, someone to give them direction and guidance for their future. And many of them find that in Jesus. And many of us need to continue to pray for this spiritual vacuum created by the revolution to be filled by Christ. There is a real spiritual hunger in Iran. Many, many hearts are looking for something other than the oppressive Islamic rule that is put on top of them each day. What I want to do now is, in my final segment, I want to bring you to a very big issue that really started immediately after the revolution, and that was the dress code. And I'm going to take you to a short soundbite here, and I want you to hear just what's going on in Iran. This is from a few years ago, but it's very timely, and it's about the Islamic dress. We're going to hear it right here on the cross in the desert.
Inappropriate, un-Islamic, and a clear sign of the Western cultural invasion. And this is why the Islamic Republic has deployed more than 70,000 moral police across the capital to stamp out any signs of Western culture among the people.
Confronting inappropriate hijabs, loud music in cars, and harassment of women in the streets will be intensified. People who are not properly dressed in their cars will be stopped and their cars confiscated for at least 1 week. The enforcement of the moral security plan was requested by the nation, and it will be continued until people's concerns are properly addressed.
For women, the rules have always been the same. Loose-fitting headscarves, tight overcoats, and short trousers that expose the skin will not be tolerated. There have even been rumors that men won't be allowed to wear necklaces, but that's something the moral police deny. Some people say all these rules and regulations can actually work against the regime.
I don't think this is a positive move by the authorities. If they instill fear and discontent among the public, it's not going to achieve anything. I'm not afraid because I don't believe I'm doing anything wrong.
I think everyone should live as they wish. No government should interfere in their lives. If they really want to prevent this issue, they must address it from the roots. Otherwise, threatening people with arrest is not going to solve anything.
I think wearing the hijab is a personal choice. We've all grown up in the Islamic Republic, and it's a cultural issue to be modestly dressed in public. So I think to put so many restrictions on people will only force them to rebel and go to the other extreme.
With the stifling summer heat, many Iranians continue to push the boundaries of the Islamic dress code. While President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has said in previous summers that he does not approve of the crackdown, the moral police works under the direct supervision of the supreme leader. So for now, Iranians will have to abide by the rules or run the risk of being fined or even arrested. Dorsa Jabari, Al Jazeera, Tehran.
This is one of the most oppressive rules that my friends on Facebook talk about more than anything. They are constantly, they say, running away when the morality police, or they call them the Ghasti or Shad, begin patrolling the streets. And yes, they will stop you as you're driving your car, too, and check the way you are dressed. They will check the way you are dressed as you're coming into university. I have a friend named Atifi. I've read this blog several times on Blog Talk. Her description of the life the daily life of an Iranian woman and what she goes through because of the dress code. Of course, as you heard in the report, you can't show more. You can't show too much skin, makeup, a fingernail polish. All of these things are scrutinized, and of course, many of my Iranian friends want to look nice and look good, but they can't do that necessarily in public. They have to run away when they see the Ghazni Irshad patrol the streets. And if you go up on Facebook, there are a couple of, YouTube, you will see a couple of short video clips of the Ghazni Irshad patrolling the streets, confronting women, stopping them. There's a lady dressed in a chador in a manito with a walkie-talkie interviewing certain Iranians and saying, do you think this is appropriate dress for a Muslim woman? They'll begin to interrogate them. I dealt with this in detail in my book, The Rose of Nowruz, Dreams of Hopes and Freedom, and I described how one of my characters, Zainab, on her way to Tehran University, was stopped by the Ghazni Irshad and interrogated. And, of course, this had such an impact on her life, and you can read about it in my book, The Rose of Nowruz. What I want to do right now, I want to take a little short musical break and let you hear from Matt Redman, his newest CD, his live worship CD, Your Grace Finds Me, is so excellent. And I want to feature one of his songs right now called Come and See on the Cross in the Desert. And we'll come right back after that with Shabnam's story.
Behold the wonder of grace so free. Behold the blessing of true forgiveness at Calvary. Behold the answer for all the broken. Behold the mercy that makes a way. Behold the promise of perfect healing at Calvary. Come and see, come and see what God has done.
Thank you. constant light waking up in this place. Hearts and lights waking up in this place. Hearts and lights waking up to the light of the world. Your light of the world.
That's Matt Redman from his latest worship project entitled Your Grace Finds Me. It's called Come and See. Some excellent, excellent songs on there. Why Does the Sky is another one, and of course, Your Grace Finds Me. I think sets the tone here on the cross in the desert. It's an invitation to come and see, to come and taste and see that the Lord is good, to see what he has done. I've talked about that spiritual void in Iran because of the oppression of religion. Many Iranians are finding their life, their hearts satisfied in Christ. I want to start a series here on Blog Talk and on Facebook called Survivors of the Revolution, looking back to 35 years ago and those individuals that live today and can testify that they have survived the revolution. One such person is Shabnam Esatali, and she is a young lady, married, living with her husband in Canada. They reside in Ottawa, Canada now. She works very, very hard as a human rights activist, and she helps newcomers and refugees, especially women, resettle in Canada. But she spends a lot of time on Facebook educating all of us about the Iranian regime and how they are violating every day the human rights of Iranians there in Iran, and she exposes their tactics. She talks about the treatment of political prisoners, the tactics of the Iranian regime. And recently, I had an opportunity to have her on my Cross in the Desert Blog Talk, and we had an interview. And she recalled her life living in Iran and what happened as a young teenager. Well, since then, I've kind of created a little video segment about Shabnam and also wrote my newest blog about Shabnam. And what I like to do always here on the Cross in the Desert is to read you my blog, to just share with you just how these particular individuals have impacted my life. And so what I'm going to do right now in our final minutes of Blog Talk this morning is share with you Shabnam's story. It's entitled Survivors of the Revolution, Shabnam's Story. Quote, I did not think that a simple conversation, having an opinion and simply expressing it, would put my life in danger. I was just 13 when Khomeini came into power. This is how Shabnam Esatali begins her story as a young teenager living in Tehran when suddenly her whole world was turned upside down. February 1, 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini arrived in Tehran, flying in from Iraq on a jumbo 747 jet, greeted by millions of protesters who had successfully caused the Shah to go into exile. A new era, a new age had begun in Iran. A new Islamic State had just been birthed. For millions of Iranians, their lives would never be the same again. Khomeini's Revolutionary Guards and morality police would now be in full control of their lives. Shabnam writes, overnight, all women, including elementary school girls, were forced to cover their heads and their bodies from head to toe and were ordered to wear only dark colors. We were no longer allowed to attend school with the opposite sex. Our once-praised school curriculum was now replaced by Arabic, Islamic studies, and the Quran. Freedom of speech became a thing of the past. If you disagreed with the new regime, you risked being arrested and never seeing your parents again. Yet Shabnam could not keep her views to herself. She experienced, quote, an awakening and felt compelled to speak her mind about the so-called new rules and values being imposed on her and all of her classmates. Eventually, the new regime arrived on her doorstep in order to silence her, and at the age of 16, just 3 years into Khomeini's reign, the Revolutionary Guard arrested Shabnam and took her away to the notorious hellhole known as Evin Prison. Quote, I did not think that a simple conversation, having an opinion and simply expressing it, would put my life in danger," end quote. Shabnam's teenage years had been rudely interrupted and transformed into a nightmare. She was now a prisoner of Khomeini in Evin prison, where the new regime was executing young teenagers on a daily basis in front of a firing squad. Yet, ironically, Shabnam's interrogator took pity on her and spared her from the torture chamber. Instead, she was left outside every day, blindfolded, cold, and hungry. Even though she had been physically spared from the grueling torture, Shabnam recalls the agony of listening to the desperate cries of prisoners begging and screaming for their deaths rather than suffering for another minute. Quote, "At night I would count around 60 to 70 bullets, which meant 60 to 70 souls had been executed, and I was hearing the last shot they would give the victims in the head," end quote. Finally, after spending 18 horrifying months in Evin prison, Shabnam was released. She was determined to find out why she had been imprisoned and why so many of her friends had been senselessly murdered. She discovered that this new regime demanded absolute compliance or else death. If teenagers were caught with books or leaflets in their possession that disagreed with the new government, they would be arrested and executed. Democracy and freedom of speech under the Shah had been replaced by an intolerant regime that ushered in a dictatorship. Women were now second-class citizens with a new dress code. The wearing of hijabs was the new law that had once been banned under the Pahlavi dynasty. The sexes were segregated, and young girls, some at the tender, innocent age of 9 years old, were now forced into marriages. Even before the new regime, Shabnam had hated God. In her mind, there was no God. He didn't exist. Shabnam recalls that shortly before the revolution, while in Turkey, her and her family were visited by Christian missionaries. Although she was resistant to their message of God's love, she remembers watching a film they brought about the life of Jesus. During the movie, Shabnam watched Jesus dying on the cross and deep down inside was touched by his act of sacrificial love. Yet, she continued to resist. Then she began having dreams about a man on a white horse. She mentioned this to her friend, and her friend replied that God was reaching out to her and calling her. Her friend began to diligently pray and fast for Shabnam, and after many other dreams, questions, Shabnam finally surrendered her heart to Christ. The young, rebellious, outspoken teenage girl had found her ultimate purpose in life. Now she knew why her life had been spared from torture and rape in Evin prison. God had a calling and purpose on Shabnam's life. Today, Shabnam is married and lives in Canada with her husband. She has went from a rebellious teenager to a powerful advocate for human rights. For many years, she produced children's programs with Transworld Radio Canada, and today helps newcomers and refugees, particularly women, resettle in Canada. Shabnam has been recognized by the Canadian Parliament as a courageous and outstanding promoter of human rights. She has not forgotten her horrifying experience in Evin prison. She continues to speak out and be a voice for Iranians today who are suffering under an oppressive government. Not much has changed in Iran, but Shabnam has changed. She has dedicated her life to speaking out against the gross and unjust violations of human rights in Iran. She is a true survivor of the revolution, and now, 35 years later, is still fighting passionately for human rights. Shabnam writes, quote, "The truth about the Islamic Republic needs to reach the ears and hearts of the world, for knowledge is the vessel of constructive change," unquote. It has been a pleasure knowing Shabnam and watching how she passionately is a voice for Iranians and human rights for everyone all over the world. She is one strong, courageous survivor of the revolution. And yet, at that young age, as a teenager, she knew she had to say something in behalf of her friends. She paid a very serious price for it, but God spared her life for a purpose and has a calling on her life. And today, she has remembered her captivity. She has not forgotten Iranians, and she continues to speak out and be a voice for them on their behalf. Well, In this last hour, we've taken a look back at the Iranian Revolution briefly and showed how it has impacted the lives of filmmakers, young people, and activists today who are continuing their mission of speaking out. This is why I do this program. I want to be a voice also for my friends in Iran who suffer for this through this every day. Oh, yes, many of them have friends. They go out, they have coffee, they go to university. But if they dare speak a word in disagreement with the government, they find that there are consequences. So many, many of them need your constant prayers. Please pray for my Iranian friends to have a better life, to have freedom, and to find their hope ultimately in Christ, because that's what the cross in the desert is all about. If you'd like to be my Facebook friend, please come to my Facebook page and friend request me. My name is Randy L. Noble. I will be glad to be your friend. You will notice on my Facebook page many, many postings about this situation in Iran. You'll see some postings about some of the books that I have written that you can also obtain. I really appreciate you spending this hour with me. And always, if you have feedback, leave me messages on my email or Facebook page. My email is rnoble1065.net. I would look forward to hearing from you. Well, I want you to have a great week. Have a great day. And if you're in the cold, come into where it's warm and enjoy that. God bless you. Thank you for listening today to The Cross in the Desert. We will see you again very, very soon.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong, it's free.